Today's lecture is going to be an introduction to tensor networks, which is, of course, a topic that you can take a whole course later in Psi about if you want. But it's quite a general tool that's now used in many different areas of physics, so I think it's good to have at least a brief exposure of it, even if you don't plan on taking that particular course. So I'm going to try to give you a bit of an exposure to what that is, and a taster, a teaser for what is coming, if you're so interested. And it's my intention today to have this as a bit of a short lecture. We can end a bit earlier, I hope. Famous last words. There's many references you can look at. One that I can recommend is a very general introduction to the whole idea of tensor networks and their applications to problems in quantum many-body physics is one that was put together by two PhD students at Sydney. The first one, Bridgman, is actually a past Psi student. These guys both put together a course to sort of teach their colleagues the introduction to tensor networks and then decided to write up their lecture notes, which you can get on the archive here, which is a introduction to tensor networks, and it basically uses the tools that we've seen so far in this course, the tools of operational quantum mechanics. So it's based around that construction of linear algebra. So have a look there if you want some further details. It's a big subject, and we're just going to have a taster of an introduction here. Okay, so here's the basic problem one has when looking at describing quantum many-body systems. You have many quantum particles in there. So already even a classical description is becoming, it's extensive. The description has to be extensive. I need just to represent even a classical state of a many-body system, I need a number of parameters, which is going to scale with the size of the system, scale with n. For quantum systems, it's even more challenging. Just thinking about how I would represent the quantum state of a spin chain of n spin half particles of n qubits on a line. This is obvious. If I have one spin, the state of one spin, I need a two vector. I need to write down, say, the components in some basis and keep those two elements. But if I have the state of n spins, it's not just that I have to write down n components, but I need to write down the component for them all being up, the component for them all being up except one being down, and then so on and so on. That's 2 to the n components, a 2 to the n element vector. So classically, it already sounds hard to describe a many-body system. You need a description, let alone figuring out the dynamics and so on, a description of the system that's scaling with n. That's hard. But in quantum, it's exponentially hard just to keep all of those coefficients in your computer. Forget about manipulating them or processing them. Just to be able to store them, you do not have to have n become very large before that becomes just intractable. You can start doing estimates on how many spins do I need before this number exceeds, you know, all the storage capacity that's available on Earth. And it's certainly nowhere close to Avogadro's number, which is what you're trying to achieve. Okay, so the basic problem is we want to write down some generic state. We're going to have a sum. This is partly just setting some notation for what we're using. We're going to have some coefficients. I sub 1, I sub 2. These coefficients are labeled by n binary indices. I can expand it out in a product state basis, but if it's entangled, then I need an exponential number of coefficients. That is just the naive and brute force description for what that quantum state would be. Right. So what could you do? Well, what did people do in the early days of quantum mechanics? Approximate. And the idea in general is that you want to approximate based on some principles to get a simpler description that you hope, because of those principles, is going to be a reasonably accurate description of what's going on. So here's one such approximation you could make, the first most naive thing that you might want to do. If the nth particle is in, if each of the n particles is in a product state, then I've reduced that exponentially large description down to a linear one. Nth particle has state. I don't know why I used n there. Let's go with ith particle. So that's what I'm using. Has state psi I. Okay, so for particle I, it's going to have a component in the up direction, and it's going to have a component in the down direction. So if there is no entanglement, if I'm describing a state with no entanglement, it's just a product of states of this form, then I have an efficient description. Of n spins. How efficient? Well, let's consider even two special cases. Case one is very efficient. All spins are in the same state. Described by this two vector B. So BI is equal to just B. Independent of I, all I need is two numbers. That's very restrictive. Every spin in the same state, it's a product state. Case two, well, I can have them all in different states. I need just a number of components that scales linearly with n. And so that's what I mean by efficient here. Does it need to be linear? If it grew quadratic, would that still be efficient? Yes. Where you draw the line is a bit vague, but certainly something that's growing exponentially in n, we're going to call inefficient. And something that's growing with some small polynomial that we can call efficient. So that's what you might do if I was trying to deal with this gargantuan Hilbert space. I might say, well, let's just try the easiest description where there's no entanglement in the system and put all of those spins in a product state. And at least now I have the possibility of writing down states for large numbers of particles. Okay, but when is that motivated? When can I do that? Well, you'd say, well, I can do that if the dynamics is such that there's not going to be a lot of entanglement in the system. Maybe it's a bunch of basically free particles that are not interacting very much, so they're not going to get entangled. And I can approximate that system by one without entanglement. That can be formulated a bit more precisely, even with interactions, as the mean field approximation. Each spin is just feeling the average interaction with all of its neighbors rather than any specific neighbor. That can turn entanglement into just correlation. And you can stay in this sort of small corner of the Hilbert space with the right approximations. But those approximations don't always hold. Sometimes we're trying to describe strongly acting, interacting quantum systems. We might want to have states where we know right from the start entanglement is going to play a role, and an important role, or we think it's going to play an important role in the behavior and predictions of that system. So what do? We have the generic case where it's exponentially large and it's almost intractable to even start. Can't do that. While this one is quite restrictive, there's no entanglement in the system, but it's efficient. Is there something in between that we can use? The general framework of tensor networks is a way to be systematic about adding additional complexity and additional degrees of freedom to your description of states and also of operations and measurements and so on, that respects certain principles that you think may describe the role of entanglement in that system, while still keeping the description well-behaved. So that's the central goal here. How can we sort of relax the restrictions in the mean field approximation to have descriptions that are still efficient, but allow for entanglement to start to be included in our description, at least in some controlled way. Okay, so before we answer that, I'm going to reframe the question in a way that'll make the answer maybe a bit more obvious. We've talked about representing states as then just vectors of the coefficients, a vector of the coefficients of all of those particles. So going back to this first slide, here's a big vector of all of those coefficients. But really, the central element here is this C that has n of these indices. And I need to know what is C potentially for any value of those indices. In this simpler description, I had this two-vector B, or a whole list of two vectors, BI, describing the system. Those things I can think of as just having a single index. What's the state of this spin? And I need to know all of those single index objects B. So let's write that out diagrammatically. I can think of those things as tensors. So an n-index tensor is a list of 2 to the n numbers. So here I'm representing C, I1, I2, I3, IN. Rather than thinking of it as one big vector, I'm thinking there's a locality structure there. I can think of what's the index for particle 1, what's the index for particle 2, particle 3, and so on. All of those things I can think of as individual legs of this tensor that can take just binary values. If it was larger spin, it could take more values. So specifying a list of states, if I say, what's the component of the state in this particular product state, where the first one's up, the second one's up, the third one's down, the fourth one's up, blah, 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 specify all of those indices, and the tensor tells me the component for that value. So it's the same thing as looking it up in this long vector that, you know, that product state also specifies some row in that very long, column in that very long vector. But it, because of the spatial structure, it's easier to think of it as this tensor. So the most general quantum state of n spins is a n-leg tensor. Each of those legs just takes a binary value, spin up or spin down. But inside that tensor is contained 2 to the n values. because I can put in 2 to the n different things on the input, and the tensor has to tell me for every one of those 2 to the n possibilities, what's the coefficient corresponding to that basis state.
This notion of tensor does not have any connection with tensors from differential geometry, right?
I mean, it's in a sense the same thing, that you specify the value of an index. It's the tensor is a map that takes you from, it's a map. I have a label space for all of my indices. And when I specify them, it gives me a function or an operator or something. So here it's a function. Often in differential geometry, you'd think of it as an operator. So yeah, it's meant to be the same thing. I need to specify a bunch of indices, and then that gets me the specific instance.
You mean a function of index slots?
Index slots. What do you mean by that?
Spin slots. So the values that have the amplitudes behind the spin can take.
Yeah. For every basis element of my space, which is just a list of indices, it will give me the amplitude corresponding to that basis element. Okay, and then let's look at the mean field case. Here we had one tensor. Where's my? A one index tensor, which is just a vector, bi. For each of the spins. So here's that one index tensor B1, which is a vector. Here's the one index tensor B2, blah, blah, blah. This one is Bn. And I just have one of them attached to each index. So the nice thing about this description is if I specify, I'm looking at the fourth spin, what's the component for spin up? I can answer that without having to know all the others. That's what a product state does. I can say, what's the component of just this spin? Whereas in the general case, I have to specify, what's the component when all the spins are in this particular state? So these are just tensor ways of representing the two descriptions that we've described so far. One, this horribly complex beast with n indices, and somehow contained within it is 2 to the n pieces of information, 2 to the n components. The bottom one, also an n index tensor, but now made up of something that is just a whole list of one index tensors, of vectors. It has an efficient description. Is there anything in between? Well, of course, the answer is yes. But maybe this picture makes it a bit easier to find a more systematic construction of that. Let's take the most general case where now we say, the state that tensor is describing might have a lot of entanglement between the different spins. Let's start seeing if we can break it down into a simpler description that looks more like the bottom one, using what we know about dealing with entangled states. In particular, I'm going to use this Schmidt decomposition, where we can write out general entangled states of two systems in terms of bases for each individual system. So this is the construction for a new type of description in the language of tensors, which we're going to call a matrix product state. We're going to take this big tensor, C, with all of these legs. And I'm going to cut it. I'm going to cut off the very leftmost spin from the rest. Now, this tensor is representing a state, and a potentially entangled state of all of those n spins. That last spin may be entangled with the rest. But I know that there exists a Schmidt decomposition of that state that I can work out in using the singular value decomposition. So let's do a Schmidt decomposition of that state. Schmidt decomposition. I know that the state psi can be written as a sum over some index nu, Schmidt coefficients, lambda nu. I wrote them as the square root there. Okay, so we need states on the left, which are now just indexed by states of that spin. Sorry, what have I just done? Let me just say that the Schmidt basis is L sub mu on the left and R sub mu for the right. So L sub mu is just states on that leftmost spin. R sub mu is states on everything else. There exists such a Schmidt coefficient. The range of this well, we know it is bounded by the lesser of the dimensions of what's on the left and the dimension of what's on the right. Okay, how are we going to write this? Can we think about this Schmidt decomposition in terms of breaking up that tensor? What we would have liked to have done, if it was a product state, we would have liked to have said, well, let's break it up into a one vector, one tensor, which is a vector, describing that state on the leftmost qubit, and then a n minus one index tensor for everything on the right. That would have been great if it divided along those lines, but it doesn't. If we have more than one Schmidt coefficient. So we're going to break that up into a sum over tensors in that Schmidt basis. So the tensors now get another index, which is labeling not just what basis they're in, but also what particular Schmidt component, so element of the Schmidt basis they're in, and what particular Schmidt component we're picking out. So I've broken up that bigger tensor into two smaller tensors. I would have liked it to just be a vector and a smaller tensor, but it's not. It's a sort of a sum over those terms, where now I've completed that sum with some internal index that I'm contracting over. That internal index is summing over the different Schmidt coefficients. And then I can repeat that process. So now let's divide that more. Let's divide along this line. Now we're going to get some general middle tensor here. This corresponds to the second spin. We'll have another set of Schmidt coefficients. We've now got a smaller leftover tensor over here. And we can continue this process until we've done it for everything. Oops. we've broken up that big tensor into a bunch of smaller tensors, each representing a local system, at the expense of having this whole sequence of contractions within describing all of these partitions of this Schmidt decomposition at each step of the process. So this range of nu, which was bounded by the lesser of dim L and dim R, that range over here on that end spin could be quite small. Once we get into the middle of the process, you have half the spins on the left, that's a 2 to the n on 2 dimensional Hilbert space, and n on 2 spins on the right, that's also a 2 to the n on 2 dimensional Hilbert space. You could have an exponential number of Schmidt coefficients in the middle. That could get actually quite a nasty sum over the middle. And that's what we're going to hopefully constrain with some principles. It's pretty standard to lump in the Schmidt coefficients with those tensors themselves, to actually just put it into a tensor, a form that looks more like this. Those lambda things are just some along the diagonal elements, so you can sort of stick them into these tensors if you want. And if I have a state of this general form,
what's inside the parentheses?
What am I writing in here?
Yeah, inside.
So here I have, I'm labeling the tensor by A, and I need an M index M to say it's acting on the mth spin.
Okay.
M plus 1, M plus 2, and so on. I can always break up a big complicated tensor into this simple form. But the internal indices that I'm contracting over might become quite large. Let's just leave that for the moment. And let's take a look at what these, okay, let's think for a moment about what do these tensors actually look like. For every value of, for every component of the spin now, before, if we were in our mean field approximation, our product state case, if I told you the value of a the basis element of a spin, this spin is up or this spin is down, what is its component? That vector would give me that component. In this case, if I tell you that index, I don't just have now a vector that I'm evaluating its component. For that index, I have an object now that needs to be contracted with its neighbors in order for me to specify what that state is. It's a bit like saying, when I have an entangled state, okay, well, what's the amplitude for being up? Well, it depends on what's the state of the other particle. Is it up or down? In this one, when I say, what's the amplitude for this particle being up? You're saying, well, it depends on sort of what its neighbors are doing on these other contractions, whether they're going to be up or down, and that'll depend on whether they're up or down, and so on. So this description is incorporating that idea of entanglement, that this specifying what the value of some state is not given just by asking what that local basis element is. I have to put it in the context of all of the other spins. Okay, so let's look at properties of this tensor and see why we're going to call it a matrix product state. Okay, let's define precisely what I mean by a matrix product state. We will define a matrix product state as one for which the coefficients I1, I2, IN, describing that state in some fixed product basis, the coefficients are given by the contractions of tensors of the form that I've just drawn. So I have for particle one, a tensor. It's got an index I1, where that's the component of that tensor. Each of these objects is itself a tensor where I'm specifying the bottom leg. And now I need to contract them together by summing over those indices here. If I specify this element, I can think of this contraction as like a matrix product multiplication. So I think of those tensors as specifying for every I sub 1, I sub 2, whatever, I'm specifying a matrix which I can then multiply together. If I can write the components as the contraction of a product of matrices, then I call this a matrix product state. So each of these elements, A, I, 1 for system I, is a, sorry, for system N, is a D by D matrix. What is this D? This is anything we want. This is part of the description of what is the matrix product state.
So
anything.
It's two, for example.
No. So the range of I sub whatever is over the indices of the qubit. This is the sum over that internal number of Schmidt coefficients. So this represents the number of non-zero Schmidt coefficients, which we're going to take to be constant throughout this entire description. So this is a D by D matrix where I, so this is really thought of as A, I, 1, N, sub mu, nu. Mu, of course, is the row, nu is the column. These things go from 1 up to D. So these things are three index tensors, where once I ask, OK, what's the component for this particular state? These are all little n's. Then it tells me not the component, but a matrix that lets me evaluate how that component sits with respect to the others. So this is like the index mu. This is the index mu. When I put two of those things together, I'm just doing matrix multiplication. That is the contraction of those internal indices. So that's going to be our definition of a matrix product state, is when a matrix product state is one for which I can take those coefficients, which could be an arbitrary form, if I can write them in this form as a contraction of a bunch of matrices describing the coefficients, then it's a matrix product state for some fixed number of, bounded number of Schmidt coefficients D. D could be very large, it can be exponentially large, but the point is I want to fix it and make it the same for all of those matrices. Okay. Yeah, so let's just make sure we're completely clear on that idea of contraction. If I wanted to take, if I want to see how this tensor that I've written out, this matrix product state, can be thought of as giving me a specific instance of that one, well, how do I go from all of these little matrices describing this, here are the A's, how do I go from that to that larger one? Well, I have to do all of those internal contractions. And there you can see that if I take A sub I 1 on particle 1, and I want to think of that as a matrix, I want to contract it with A sub I 2 on particle 2. I contract it by summing over the rightmost leg on system 1 and the leftmost leg on system 2, which gets contracted over. There I'm just doing matrix multiplication. Now you can see that I'm just describing a new matrix described by the product of those two matrices. This object I can write as, here's A1. It's got three legs, I1, mu, alpha. Here's A2. It's got three indices, I2, nu, and alpha, and I'm summing over alpha. In the diagram, having that internal index in this matrix product state just corresponds to multiplying those matrices. Then I could say, well, if I have a list of such matrices describing my state, I can contract them all together. That will just give me an n-leg tensor, which is describing my state. Okay, let's look at an example because this can be very abstract. Let's look at how we might describe what's called the GHZ state. It's the ground state of the 1D quantum Ising model. There's a degeneracy in that model where the ground state can be in the all zero state, or it can be in the all one state. And the GHZ state is the equally weighted superposition of the two. Okay, two observations about this. On the one hand, here is an n particle state that I have a nice efficient description for. I just wrote it out. It's really only got two non-zero components. So I expect if I'm trying to, you know, deal with states that are like the GHZ state, I should have no trouble coding them into my computer. And sort of by inspection, you're like, yeah, I can see how to write that out. It's just got those two coefficients. On the other hand, looking at this from the perspective of a, you know, the mean field approximation as a product state, this is not a product state. It's very highly entangled. If I try to start off understanding a problem that involves this state, and I had made the mean field approximation, and I said, I'm going to assume my state is a product state or something close to it, then I would have trouble reproducing some of the properties of this particular state. I would not be able to capture any aspect of entanglement in this state, either with that mean field approximation, treating it as a product state, or even adding sort of small variations to it, because of this sort of global amount of entanglement in that state. However, the matrix product formalism gives you a nice simple way to represent that state. Let's pick the matrices which normally depend on n, on what particle we're talking about. We're going to make them independent of n. And we're going to have them, their matrices for spins. So we specify a pair of matrices, one for spin up and one for spin down. The matrix for spin up will look like this. The matrix for spin down will look like this. And if we take the trace of, so we have an AI, one, AI two, AI three, dot, 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 AIN. You can say, okay, here's how I'm trying to represent the components of my state. I plug in, okay, for a particular basis state, say all zeros, or what's the component in the basis 0000001, or whatever selection of indices I choose. I specify it and I evaluate this matrix product. You can see from properties of those matrices that the only time this thing will ever evaluate to anything other than zero is if it's a product of all A zeros or it's a product of all A ones. So that says this complicated thing, I can stick in any component, query it, say, what's the component of this state in this, what's the coefficient for this component of the state? It will always give me zero unless I say, what's the component of all zeros or the component of all ones? And I've obviously forgot a normalization factor there, but. So this is psi of n in some basis I1 to IN. I'm looking for the components of the state, and the components are given now not by just looking up an element in a vector, but I've got to do a little calculation. I've got to multiply a bunch of matrices together to get the component. But that is something that is an efficient process. Certainly, it's going to be very easy for you to program MATLAB to do that. Matrix multiplication is going to scale nice and polynomially with a low order polynomial in the size of the system. Okay, I think you're going to get lots of examples to play with in your tutorial. Okay, what might you be able to calculate with these matrix product states? Correlation functions are straightforward. If I have a state described by some matrix product state, and I want to know a correlation function between an observable at some site and an observable at some distant site. I can represent this calculation as taking the matrix product state represented in a diagram. There's my matrix product state. Now I think, how do those, that observable I'm looking at, O on the zero spin and O on the J plus one spin act? Well, O is some operator that acts on the spin just on one site, so I can think of it as a two index tensor that acts. So this is representing O sub zero. There's another operator acting way over here, O sub J plus one on the J plus one site. It's just taking that index, acting on it as a matrix, spitting out its coefficients of that operator when acting on that spin. And now I want to calculate the expectation value of that operator in the original state. So I need to take a contraction of this description of the state with its bra vector. And so I just flip around this diagram and contract those indices. Let me represent this object, which is a new type of tensor given by contracting one of my matrices in my matrix product states around my operator. Can I evaluate this thing? Yeah. Well, I mean, what does that picture even mean? It means I'm taking the tensor AI. I'm taking its transpose down at the bottom. And I'm acting with the operator as a matrix on that, and summing over that index. Zero to d minus one. Yep.
Couldn't the support of the operator be bigger than one?
So here I was thinking of it as a local operator. So it's acting just on one spin. Yeah. So if in general, if it acts on a few, it would have support on some fixed number. You can then calculate the equivalent object there. Okay, in between here, we have a much simpler contraction, which is this one, without the operator in between. This is, again, just given by an expression in terms of matrices in the matrix product. Given by that. And then this calculation has a whole bunch of, I mean, we haven't defined any boundary conditions there, but we have, I'm just going to use E sub infinity to represent however I'm setting either the infinite chain or some boundary conditions off there on the left. That's not really going to affect our calculation. We have this operator here, O on zero, that we have now J copies of this identity operator in the middle. We have this operator, carried away and jumping ahead of my equation. Let me fix that. What I'm trying to work out is what this expression is. This is going to equal the trace of this. Now we have the operator at J plus one. Then we have all the remaining operators out there on the right. Again, I have now on sort of a double the size space, I have a nice matrix multiplication expression for how this correlation function is going to behave, which I can evaluate explicitly, although I can already tell you something about the type of behavior that I would get in a matrix product state. as I extend J, so those two operators become farther and farther apart, often what I'm interested in a correlation function is just how it scales with the distance between those operators. The question then is, as I take the jth power of this identity operator in the middle, that identity operator is determined just by properties of the matrix product state, not the observable we're looking at. It just depends on A. As I take powers of that, what happens to it as an operator? Well, think about its eigenvalues. If it has eigenvalue 1, then I can take arbitrary powers of it, and it's going to maintain that eigenvalue 1. In which case, this correlation function is going to be basically independent, constant, of how separated those two observables are. If its eigenvalue is less than 1, then as I take it to the jth power, that's going to tell me exactly how that correlation function is going to decay. It's going to decay exponentially in the distance between those two observables. So one of the things you can work out just with the matrices right away in that matrix product state is I can figure out what's the spectrum of this operator that I've constructed from those matrices. If it's got an eigenvalue 1, I know that there's going to be correlation functions which are constant in that state, independent of the size of the system. And if it's an eigenvalue less than 1, it's going to tell me how those correlation functions are going to decay exponentially with what, exactly the form of that decay. So this goes as nu to the j, where this is the largest eigenvalue of A, of E, I. Okay, I said I was going to end reasonably early, so let me think about what else we want to say here. Maybe just one more sort of general comment on the use of the use of MPS in describing one-dimensional spin chains. So generally, people say that this particular type of tensor network description, matrix product states, are a good description for ground states of gapped 1D spin chains. Why is that? Well, there's a proof by Hastings, which is that all gapped 1D spin chains have a ground state that satisfies an area law. Meaning that the entanglement of any region of that spin chain, the entanglement between any region and the rest of the spin chain is actually fixed. I mean, the area, the boundary of that region is just 2 points. It's a constant. And so the entanglement between an area and the outside is going to be bounded. Bounded entanglement between any region and its complement. this, I mean, he basically proved this result using techniques of matrix product states, but the existence of that bound on the entanglement sets an upper limit on the number of Schmidt coefficients that you need. That sort of sets the dimension for the matrices in a matrix product state description for that ground state that are going to describe that entanglement structure. Yeah?
What do you mean by it sets an upper bound for the number of variables you need?
I said it sets an upper bound on the number of Schmidt coefficients that are needed in a matrix product state expression for the ground state.
An upper, because everything we're doing here is an approximation, right?
So
these are not exact results.
So
in order to write down the ground state of a not completely trivial system with MPS, you do need extensively many parameters. It's just a very, very good approximation for small number of parameters.
Yes. So you've got exactly the right point. So what we've talked about in terms of the existence of matrix product states so far is there's no approximation because I haven't put any bound on the size of those matrices on the indices. And as I mentioned, that the number of Schmidt coefficients, when I cut a spin chain right in the middle, can be exponentially large in the number of particles in that system. Because the number of Schmidt coefficients is sort of only bounded by the dimension of the smaller of the systems on either side. Now, the question is, can we describe systems with matrix product states that have some nice bounded number of Schmidt coefficients? The size of those matrices is scaling nicely with the size of the system. Maybe even it doesn't scale with the size of the system at all. It can be like this example of the GHZ state where it's fixed and independent of the size of the system. So the beauty of this Hastings result, it's Hastings, by the way, this beauty of this Hastings result is that because of his proof that all gap spin chains have a ground state satisfying an area law and it bounds the entanglement, and that means we can approximate those ground states to arbitrary accuracy using a dimension on our matrices which scales nicely with that accuracy parameter and does not scale with the size of the system. So it's an approximation to the ground states, but it's in a sense a good approximation is that it can be controlled as good as you want in a way that's independent of the size of the system. So this is one of the most important properties of these matrix product states and of tensor networks in general, is the expectation that when we have an area law in a system, we're going to be able to get good, efficient descriptions of the ground states. That's hard to say in higher dimensions, but in 1D we can say, because of these results, that we have efficient matrix product state descriptions for the ground states, which are as accurate as we want. Okay, so that the key in that accuracy really is the slight little jump between bounding the entanglement between the rest of the system and bounding the number of Schmidt coefficients. Number of Schmidt coefficients is only sort of a rough measure of entanglement. You can have bound entanglement with only an exponentially decaying Schmidt coefficient profile that doesn't ever exactly go to zero. But we're going to truncate it at some point, and that's going to set an accuracy parameter which is controllable. So the key result here is that, basically that MPS with fixed dimension D can approximate these ground states of gapped 1D spin chains with arbitrary accuracy. Uh, Okay, so that was a brief introduction to one particular type of tensor network. This is a very active field of research, especially here at PI, where people have tried to generalize a lot of the nice properties of MPS, both to describing more complex type of entanglement structures in the state, and to going to higher dimensions. And so that's really the forefront of the field at the moment, is trying to say, what are good ansatz that I can make for taking this tensor that describes my general state, which can be arbitrarily complicated, and representing it in some constructive way using a bunch of bite-size, you know, efficient tensors, and doing a bunch of internal contractions to construct that larger tensor that's capturing the essential physics of the model I'm trying to describe. It's not at all obvious how to say, here's the properties of the physics or the entanglement structure that I'm trying to capture. Here's going to be the right way to decompose my, you know, large tensor into some contraction of bite-sized smaller ones. And coming up with the good constructions to use as ansatz for describing states is really where the field is at the moment. Okay, questions? Yeah?
No, please.
Oh, thank you. So the whole idea is saying that actually there's a better way than just going brute force and calculating all those coefficients that we saw first, that there are actually some internal structures that we at first don't see, and those are less coefficients. We can use less numbers to describe that thing, if it's entangled or something like that. I'm trying to understand the ideas.
Yeah, I mean, so there's many perspectives on how you view those internal contractions within this tensor. You know, do I think of something real is going on there, or is it just, you know, a useful tool that I'm making sense of to do my contractions? I mean, it, you know.
But the message at the end is that I will need less numbers to describe my quantum state or not?
Yeah, the goal is to find efficiently, first of all, tensor constructions where it's efficient even to describe the tensors, and it's efficient to do the contractions needed over those tensors to calculate useful things. Okay. What types of constructions are going to be efficient in both of those ways that is also capturing the essential physics of the problem I'm trying to solve? That's the central question here. Matrix product states provides the canonical example for doing that, where we clearly know, because of these types of results, that it's the right description for gapped 1D spin chains. Now you say, well, what if it's not gapped? How can I generalize this construction? What if I'm going to 2D? How can I generalize this construction? And, you know, then none of the proofs hold, so you have to then try to say, what can I say confidently about the results that I'm getting out of that construction. You had a question?
It's about kind of like, in practice, you have to find these coefficients, right? And there could be many. So, like, is anytime you use tensor networks, does it lead to like large variational problems where like you have to train like the ansatz to get like.
So yes, that is certainly one, and perhaps the dominant approach is a numerical approach to constructing the tensors to describe some particular model through some variational method. Okay, I give you a Hamiltonian. Now I pick an initial starting point. What's the energy of this under that Hamiltonian? Is it the ground state? Do I lower that energy by doing some systematic variation of the elements of those tensors? That's one approach. You can also, you know, try to, using your knowledge of the system, impose constraints on how those tensors have to be, or symmetries. You know, a huge area at the moment is imposing symmetries on tensor networks in a consistent way. That's reflecting something you think is important for the system. And then adapting some of those numerical methods to the situation where those symmetries are enforced. Okay, that's it for today. Thanks. Last lecture tomorrow, we're going to look at quasi-probability representations and Wigner functions.